Thank you very much, Dave. It's a challenge for me to give this talk for three reasons. One is it's a mixed audience, so there are a lot of people who are experts in the field. There are also people who have peripheral interest in this subject. So if I go too slowly, you can doze off, and if I go too fast, ignore me. And so that's, I'm going to try to aim somewhere in the middle with some introduction and give you some degree of excitement. Secondly is that astronomy is often the subject of images, and we're very much guided by observation. And to talk with without any image and without any figures is a challenge. And I would not even use the blackboard. I would just wave my hands as a normal, well, at least the most esteemed astronomers, cosmologists would usually do. And third, it is a subject which is perhaps the subject that touches us all, and we all have some knowledge of the background, and we all know what the solar system is all about. And at one point in our education, we all learned a little bit, and then what is there still to do? After all, the great minds have already taken care of all of the fundamental issues, and what is there to do? And briefly, let me just go through, I have these notes in front of me for my own reference, so I can, I'm getting old these days and I can't remember everything. And so I just touch on some excitement in this subject, and it's meant to have an overview, so it touches many different aspects. But at the end, I'll bring back to where the central points are and the most dominant in my own personalized opinion, and what is, are the most central issues. So perhaps sort of the overriding issue, if I were to speak to a public, an overriding issue is one of the three questions that you get asked when you get on the airplane. You tell them, somebody who sits next to you, that you're an astronomer, and the first question always comes is, are we alone in the universe? Okay, and to answer that issue, I'm not going to touch any aspect of that issue today, but one aspect of that issue is really, in order to really say that whether we are alone or not, is to see whether there are places that life could evolve. And so that's what this subject is all about, try to understand our origin and try to understand whether the solar system is unique, and do we actually form by accident, or did we form as a some sort of a dynamical necessity? And how did it lead to, you know, what is kind of dynamical process or physical process of various kind that led to the property of the solar system as we see it? And is this architecture in the solar system unique, or is it just a representative sample of all that is out there around every star? So the issue of ubiquity, our planets out there, and the issue of dynamical diversity are the central driving points in understanding the process of planet formation, perhaps the theory of planet formation, if one could evolve a discipline as such. So to address that issue, we need to ask the question whether what we see in the solar system is the process of, or is the relic of some process that led to the formation of the solar system. In other words, what we see today, is it something that already cast in stone, as it were, say the first few million years after the solar system was formed? Or do planets bear the signature of continuous evolution? Okay, how, and did it matter what happened after the first few million years to today? You know, solar system is 4.6 billion years old now, and so was there anything in between? And did that fundamentally change planetary system? Okay, well, I said this is an ancient subject because it doesn't take much to go out there to see that planets are lined up in the sky. They follow the same circle, great circle, that the sun and the moon passes through the sky. The planets all go through that circle. And it's called the circle of the ecliptic. And even back to 2,000 years ago, people realized the reason is the ecliptic is because all the planets were on the same plane. So, in fact, the attempt has always been to understand the motion of the planets inside this plane. And by the definition of planet, I should mention that planet, according to Greeks, are objects which move relative to the background objects. So the planets, the term planets means wanderers. And they're wanderers is because they move relatively fast around the sun. So in our own perspective, they move around. And so today, do we call planets all those objects that moves around another star? Well, that's a bad definition because there are stars going around other stars. And so what is fundamentally different from planets compared to stars? Well, in terms of dynamics, people did a lot of early calculations or studies of planets, Newton, Laplace, Poincaré, tried to understand planets really as a little point mass, not just a simple point mass that only respond to the gravity of the central star, but they themselves perturb each other. So it's a weak perturbation, okay? And because it's a weak perturbation, you can develop sophisticated mathematical tools even with a linear approach. And you can start to develop understanding of these planetary systems. Newton's focused his analysis of the planets primarily on yearly timescale, namely how planets move around the sun, you know, orbit after orbit. But he did get worried when that formula didn't quite do so well when it comes to describing the moon, because his formula actually could not predict the moon that accurately. It worried him. He developed some linear perturbation to take into account of the perturbation of the sun. It was Laplace who, in an effort to show that the entire universe can be determined in terms of a deterministic mechanical world, developed the next step. And he understood everything about the solar system on the time scale of a few million years. And then we got stuck. And how do we understand solar system on even longer time scale? It took a Frenchman to defeat another Frenchman. It was Poincaré who eventually showed that the entire solar system evolution is rather chaotic. I'll come back to that. So the concept of the planets forming in a disk already became very appealing. You know, this is an assumption that, okay, what we see is how we were formed here. So it today we attribute the idea that planets form in a disk to Laplace, but in fact, before Laplace, Descartes and Kant has already these concepts. So these are the classical stuff, and everyone knows about this history. So what's new in the last 40 years? In the last 40 years, what is new are in three different fronts. One front is in the area of solar system exploration. We were able to go to different parts of the solar system, did reconnaissance, and to study the dynamics and to study the composition of these objects. Perhaps the most profound discovery in the solar system exploration are two. One is the realization that giant planets such as Jupiter, incidentally I should just say that the planets in the solar system are divided into two group of planets, three group of planets, the terrestrial planets, which compose of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, the gas giants, which are mostly, there are two, Jupiter and Saturn, and they are called gas giants because most of their mass, more than 60% of their mass, is in the form of hydrogen or helium, and it's a gaseous form. And then there are two more objects which are called ice giants. Ice giants are Uranus and Neptune, and these objects have total mass about 17 and 19 Earth masses, but 90% of that mass is in heavy elements. When we talk about heavy elements, we refer to anything but hydrogen and helium, okay? So these are three group, so this is one important realization, is the realization that gas giant planets and terrestrial planets, sorry, gas giant planets and ice giant planets have cores. And cores much similar to perhaps that of, you know, the structure of Earth. The second very important revelation is the study of meteorites. By looking at these meteorites, we see that we can pick up truly that object that was left over from 4.6 billion years ago. Now, for those of you who came to last week's presentation by Bob Kirshner, and you realize that he talked about the transition from de-accelerating to accelerating universe occurred at about redshift of 0.6. I want to caution you that, I want to tell you that that is exactly the moment the solar system formed. Okay, so it was not by accident. Okay, so that's with regard to the solar system formation, and so the one clue, or the two major clue that came in the case of solar system exploration are the realization, yes, of Jupiter's core and the meteorites, yes.
So what is the evidence that well, Jupiter and the ice giants have cores?
Well, yes, okay. Now, there are several ways to look at this system, okay? Now, Jupiter itself is, well, there are two ways. One way is to look at the moments, the gravitational moments, and you try to probe the interior structure. The other is to do evolution calculation, try to fit the present size and the amount of energy that's liberated from Jupiter or Saturn. So therefore, you can infer something about the internal structure. Now, in the context of these inference, it's not 100% secure that they all indeed have cores. But in the case of Saturn, in the case of Uranus and Neptune's, it seems to be very difficult to get out the conclusion they have cores. But the sort of enhancement of heavy elements is definitely there. Okay, so that's the first aspect. The second aspect is in the last 40 years, we're able to send up lots of satellites, space probes. And these space probes enabled us to look in the infrared wavelengths, you know, to the outer space, because our own atmosphere is opaque to this infrared radiation. And this is very important because that these type of protostellar disks, or the solar nebula, as envisioned by Kent and Laplace, they tend to radiate in the infrared temperature because their temperature is rather low. We can't see it on Earth. Okay, we have to send satellites to go out there in space to see it. So, and what we find is remarkable. Around young stars, you know, if you look out tonight, you see the Orion Nebula. Okay, there's one star, three star there, and one star down there. Just below the Orion Belt, there's a patch of a cluster of stars. And these are very young stars. These stars are about 2 to 4 million years old. In these clusters, when we look at star clusters as young as the Orion Nebula, that almost 100% of these stars bear signatures of protostellar disks. These signatures comes out in the infrared, and they really tell you about the size. They tell you, and they a millimeter infrared and in these wavelengths, and they tell you about the size of these disks, which are anywhere between a few times that of the solar system current dimension to be somewhat a little bit bigger, and they have masses comparable to the solar system planets in heavy elements, and And so they have all of the signatures, what we think may be the nursery out of which that planets are formed. Okay? Now, but yet, when we look at these stars, which are older than just a few million years old, we can go to, you know, 10 million year old stellar clusters, by then, we see that all these signatures are gone. That casts a time scale out of which that planets may, you know, can form, okay? So, and I want to come back to this point of time scale. Time scale is one of the major challenges to formation of planetary systems. So we see that from young stellar systems, that all of the material, all of the material that eventually end up inside these young stars went through a disk. This is not surprising. If you turn on the bathtub, okay, turn on the water, all of the water that goes down the drain went through a whirlhole and then went down the drain because they had a little bit of angular momentum to begin with. So when this stuff contracts, the conservation angular momentum helped them to spin up and they form a disk rather naturally. And we can see that the type of disk we see in here and to the type of disk we expect to form from the interstellar cloud, we can see that this disk forms very naturally. Okay, now that's the second area. Then the third area really happened in the last 10 years. And in the last 10 years, what's the most significant discovery is the discovery of extrasolar planets, planets around other stars. And now we see that at least 10% of all the sample that people study or identify so they can go out there to look for planets, and they found planets. Now, how did they find these planets? They find these planets by not directly seeing the image of the planet, because that's very difficult. You see the influence of the planet on their whole star. As planet dance around the star and their they cause some reflex motion of the star. And just to give you an impression of what we're talking about here is that you're really trying to detect motion of the star down to the level of about a couple of meters, 3 meters per second. Hopefully we should be able to do even better than that, but at the moment this is the best we can do. Now 3 meters per second is 1 pi × 10⁷, delta lambda over lambda in terms of redshift, and it's 1 pi × 10⁷. The spectral resolution for these guys is 1 pi × 10⁵. So how do you get something out, you know, and you can't even resolve the spectra, and you get out to 1 pi × 10⁷? So you look at many lines simultaneously to a correlation, and people are doing this right now. They're also looking at the possibility that these planets may go in front of their host star to block out a little bit of the light, okay? And that is also being used as a method to detect planets. Of course, the most exciting thing is what is there in the future, and we would like to directly image planets, not only gas giants, but also terrestrial planets. So far, all of the planets we find today are Jupiter-like planets. They have much larger mass than the Earth, primarily because they provide the strongest signal. The Earth-like planets, we can't yet detect them, but it doesn't mean that they don't exist. So, and one of the aims for this theoretical studies is to try to see whether we can infer the existence of Earth-like planets from the presence of gas giants. Because in order to detect them, to work out the next generation instrument that we need to do this, and we need to know, we need to have some estimate. What is the percentage probability of finding planets around nearby stars? Okay, so what are the challenges for theory? These are the observations, this is the background. I give you an introduction of what is old, what is new, and what are the opportunity provided us to develop a theory of planet formation. What are the challenges? Well, within the solar system, the challenge is how do we try to come up with theory that will come up naturally to explain the dynamical architecture and the chemical architecture of the solar system? how do I put it very simply? You know, there are many, many complications. You know, it's like a four blind man try to feel an elephant. They can each tell you about all of the differences. But what are the central points? If you only have 2 points you want to work on, what are the 2 points? Well, chemical architecture. If you look at the chemical architecture, we know that we are standing on a planet whose average density is about 5 grams per cc, and is mostly made of silicates. Okay, now silicates condense at about 600-700 degree K in these very low pressure environment. If we go further in, go to where mercury is mostly made of iron. Okay, and these guys condense primarily at about 1,000 or so Kelvin. If we go further out, we look at Jupiter and we look around the satellites of Jupiter, we find they're mostly made of ices. They condense at around 160, 170 K in these very low pressure environments. So there seems to be a sequence that lies out. You know, you say, well, closer to the sun is hotter and further away is cooler. And there seems to be this sequence, but is this sequence natural? Okay, why then couldn't I have a lot of iron further out? And is this sequence very natural? And why couldn't I mix them, form them, and then if I form way out in the outer solar system, lots of big ice balls, and I bring very close to the sun, I could, in principle, get these planets come into very close to the sun with 1,000 kilometer deep ocean. We don't see any of that. Why is that? Dynamical architecture. What is a dynamical architecture? Well, now, of course, dynamics is one subject. It's so elegant that it inspired many, many, you know, great minds, from Kepler to Newton. And they were trying to think of all sorts of things. And most of their things came out to fruition, such as Newton's law of gravitation. But there are other things which didn't, such as Bode's law. And most of us don't think much of Bode's law. What is Bode's law? If we look at the spacing between planets, we find that the planets have a lot of elbow room. Okay? They could be anywhere, but they have a lot of elbow room. And what is that elbow room caused of? Okay, this is not following exact atomic orbits or some particular resonance, and they're not in that kind of exact configuration, but they have a lot of elbow room. And this elbow room turns out to be very important, because with this elbow room, that the solar system, the inner part of the solar system, is stable to the perturbation of other little planets, you know, perturbing them to each other. Okay, so now the time scale for this perturbation to start to generate anything exciting, it's about 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 16 years. Okay, and we have only lived here for about 10 to the 9 years. So on that time scale, we were able to have a metastable or stable configuration out of which then intelligent life, complex life, evolved. Had the solar system been unstable, the environment would change drastically. Okay? So now, is that the general case, or is that an exception? Now, why is it that we get into a case where the system become relatively stable? Now, this transition to quasi-stability, and it's a phenomenon, I think, it's very common in nature. If I may draw an analogy, it's sort of like growing up in a big family, you know, and you're dominated by your two parents, and your sibling always agitate you a little bit. Okay, most of these agitation is a tiny perturbation, it doesn't amount to anything. But over the years, you really have a big blow up, okay? And then somebody gets kicked out of the family, the one remains become very eccentric. What I want to show you is that in the solar system or in planetary system, this sort of thing also happens. Okay? So the one challenge, I said, is a dynamical architecture and chemical architecture of the solar system. What causes this type of structure? Is it by accident? Or is it Is there some reason, dynamical reason for this?
The only way to do that is by simulation.
Not necessarily so. I think it's by thinking.
Good.
I think
there's no way of getting any evidence.
Well, right. Well, the only way to do it is by looking at other systems as well to see whether.
You mean you can think about it analytically as well? That's really
important. Right. I agree. I mean, a lot of simulation is needed, but I think we need to do more than just simulation. Okay. And then there's also the second point is that, as I said right from the beginning, astronomy is very much observationally driven. Okay, just like physics is very much experimentally driven to some extent. I shouldn't say it here, and there's a big T in this place. But so we need to do tests. And the ultimate question is that do planetary systems represent, you know, it has the makeup of statistical mechanics along the line of thermodynamics more than the makeup of, let's say, atomic structure, which you're looking at individual cases. So the second point I want to say about is the solar system is the challenge is a time scale problem, okay? And as I said right from the beginning, there is a time scale problem because we see gas goes away. And if there are cores inside these giant planets, the core better form first before the gas get there, goes away. Okay, so that at least is one, one type of bias scenario is that we may need to form this core first. Is there a way to form this core afterwards? We'll discuss some aspect of that in a bit. So we already have a clock with regard to how fast the gas goes away. Well, do we have a clock on how fast the gas goes away? We say, oh, wow, the signature of the disk goes away. Now, but the signature of the disk is mostly in the form of infrared radiation. And most of that infrared radiation today that we see comes not from the gas, but from the reflection or the reprocessing of the dust, okay, of the dust material, stuff like ice, stuff like silicates, and they reprocess the stellar radiation. We see these. But in the next few years, we will have satellites which will probe for us the amount of gas around these stars, young stars, whether they go away on the time scale of a few million years. But currently, we think they go away. We have this bias to think that the gas and the dust really goes away together on the time scale of a few million years. Okay. Now, we can also look back into our own solar system. We see the relic of solar system formation in the form of these grains. We see inside these grains, they have little nuggets of carbon aluminum, calcium aluminum inclusions, and with concentrated decay product of radioactive material, where you can do some dating about how fast it took these chondrules, these meteorites to condense. And that time scale turns out to be of order about a million years or so. Okay, so you have some kind of constraints here. And then finally, there's also the constraint that if you look at the outer part of the solar system, really way out near the edges, and we see that there are some interesting things there. There are things what we call Kuiper belt objects. These Kuiper objects have pretty big size. Well, not by solar system standards, but you know, sizes up to 100 kilometers or so. And it's way out there. And way out there is difficult for them to assemble all this thing together. And for not only you have to assemble them together, it seems that they are also on this kind of resonance with planets, ice giants such as Neptune. Neptune somehow has caught these guys onto resonances. And it didn't form on the resonance, and it's probably caught there, and it's not by accident. And to get all of this configuration going, it takes time. So what are the constraints of all these times? That's the second challenge. The first challenge is the architecture. The second challenge is time scale. And the third challenge is ubiquity of extrasolar planets. We already see today, even with a little bit, we're seeing the tip of the iceberg, we are already seeing enormous percentage of stars, at least 10% of stars, with these gas giants. We don't know whether they have, 100% of them have it, because the database is not yet long enough for us to pick up the signal from planets with period longer than just a few years, okay? And we're still, the jury is still out. What is the percentage? But we know the minimum lower mass is already 10%. Now, how do we form these things? Now, currently, even the theory of solar system formation find it very difficult to form planets like Jupiter in our own solar system, okay? How do you do it in such a common way around all of these stars out there? What can we learn from that? Extrasolar planets provides not only a challenge in the form of ubiquity, but also diversity. They're not like our own solar system at all. Okay, the ones we can see right now. Most of them have periods ranging from 3 days onwards. We don't have any planets with period less than 4 months. And these guys have big Jupiters. Now, Jupiters in our solar system, gas giants, have periods of 10 years. And these guys have 3 days onwards. And so that's a great difference. They have high eccentricity. Most of our solar system, the planets are on relatively simple circles. But in these guys, they have eccentricity up to 0.7 or more. So what is the origin? How did we get this diversity? What is the onset? What is the cause for the onset of diversity? Okay, so now I'm going to go through, I give you post enough challenges. I'm now going to go through the several steps along the way, how to develop a complex, comprehensive theory of planet formation. I'm going to go through 6 steps. There are many other steps. I won't, go into details, but you can generally categorize in these 6 steps. And there are many interesting issues associated with it. I'll just give you a overview. The first step is the formation of the central star itself, okay? The sun at the center, and that comes from the collapse, gravitational collapse of the clouds from the surrounding region. And under what condition do you have this star collapse, or this cloud collapse? And this is the issue of star formation. Star formation provides a link, a conduit, in the understanding of not only planet formation, but also stellar system formation, and for that matter, galaxy formation. It is a conversion of this diffuse gas into these individual central star, and that is the important event which led to, say, the environment out of which you can form planets. So that's the first step. The second step is around these newly formed stars, there are clouds of gas that form disks. From these disks, and you have heavy elements that condenses into grains. And the evolution of the grains in this environment is the second step. How do you condense, grow grains to start to form what we call planetesimals? Planetesimals are these, there's no clear-cut definition of where is dust, where is planetesimal. You may as well just cut it at about 10 kilometers. Why 10 kilometers? Smaller than 10 kilometers, you're strongly influenced by the gas in the surrounding region. Above 10 kilometers, they are weakly influenced. Okay, so the third step is from these 10-kilometer planetesimals, you build up cores. Cores like the moon, like Mercury, and like Earth. And these we call cores, and the reason we refer to them as cores is we have gas giant planet in mind, and then eventually they sit in the middle of gas giant planets. Now these things collide through collisions, and we have a lot of clues. We see it in the sky. We look at Mercury, we look at the moon, it's full of craters, impact craters, clearly impact is an important process that led to their formation. So how do you understand the dynamics of that led to these type of process? The fourth step is gas accretion. Gas giants such as Jupiter and Saturn are primarily made of gas. So at some point, it is very important, there's an onset that they went through, bang, they start to accrete gas. But there's a very clear-cut difference between the Earth-like objects and Jupiter-like objects. What causes this difference? Why are these group of planets which have rather little gas, the total amount of gas on Earth is no more than few parts per million. But yet, over there, in these Jupiter-like objects, they have much bigger amount of gas. More than 90% of them is in the form of gas in Jupiter. In the case of Saturn, it's more than 60%. So what makes that difference? Is it the temperature of the disk? Is it the mass of the central core? So that's another step along the way. So that's a fourth step. Okay. The fifth step is that we don't see much gas between the planets today. Our solar system is relatively clear. So that gas somehow gone away. During that process of going away, what I hope to impress you is this is a very important moment. It's a moment that causes enormous amount of infant mortality. Okay? Just like these turtles, okay, when they lay eggs, the sea turtles, they lay eggs on the sand, and they first fertilize them, they lay the egg on the sand, and they incubate in the sand. On the way down to the sea, there's an enormous amount of infant mortality, and that is important process in the formation of the solar system. And finally, the final step is that planetary evolution, dynamical evolution, is an ongoing process, okay? We don't form and then it goes through a dead quiet period forever and ever. It's an ongoing process. But what determines the ongoing process being going through a rapid phase of transition or goes through steps of phase transition, metastable phase transition, perhaps along the same way that in the biological evolution. Okay, now, so I lay out the six steps. Now I'm going to go through the detailed issues in each one of the steps, okay? I'm only going to touch on some of the issues, not every issue, but touch on some of the issues. Star formation. The star formation process occurred on a timescale about 100,000 years. Okay, how do we know that timescale? Well, we see that stars are formed in dense cores of gas clouds. And these dense cores, their dynamical collapse timescale is of order 10 to the 5 years. Okay? And we see that whenever we can look at the central star, by the time we can peek at the central star, which is already formed, we can look at their color magnitude diagram, and which indicate that these stars are relatively young. They're so young, they're no more than about 100,000 years. Now, the central issue here is, first, that all gas, I want to repeat this, all gas that went into the star went through the disk. Now, why is this important? Why is this important? Because planets are formed in this disk, okay? So how much material do we have to form planets here? Do we have all of the material that went through the disk, or what we see at the very end? Okay, so how do you work out what is available to you? And this determines the whole process. There's a lot of material available for you at the very beginning. There's very little material available at the very end. So what is available, you don't have time. What you have time is not available. And I feel like that sometimes. When I'm young, I spend time to save money. And when I'm old, I spend money to save time. And it's almost exactly the same type of process that goes on in the solar system formation. One, all gas that goes through the disk, all the gas that is in the star went through the disk. And then if that's the case, what determines among the material that gets left behind to form this solar system. We know if we count up all of the heavy elements in the planets today, it amounts to 2% of all of the heavy element that's in the sun. Okay? So we know in terms of the heavy elements, we left behind this much. What determines that 2%? Why not 100%? Why not 0%? If the process of leaving behind heavy element is 100%, then every star we form, it will be pure hydrogen and helium. Okay? But we know that's not the case. We see it out there. Stars with different metallicity, they have what's called solar metallicity. They're not metallicity that you could say they can generate during their stellar evolution, but most of this stuff that generate during the stellar evolution doesn't get up to the top. So we see inside these systems, they are able to get most of the material into the center. Okay, but why is it not 100%? If it's 100%, then the probability of forming planets would be zero, because we have nothing out here to form the terrestrial planets. And if they're indeed ubiquitous, more than 10% of these stars have it, and maybe 100% have it, so then we have to leave some behind. What is it that we leave behind? How much do we leave behind? We can look at that question, again, appeal to observation. We can look into a cluster of stars. These cluster of stars, such as the Orion, such as the Pleiades, which you can also see now, these stars are formed with the same age. Presumably, they form out of the same cloud, okay, out of the same material. We can compare their chemical composition, one star against another, okay? We can do observation to make that comparison, and that comparison tells you a remarkable chemical homogeneity down to the level of 5% at the moment. We don't know whether it's even better than that. We see this remarkable chemical homogeneities among the stars. Somehow, when they become mature, they all seem to have the same. Okay? So this is a key question. What is it that, you know, decide how much material that you can leave behind to form planets? And then what determines the time scale? What is it, you know, how much material gets in there is determined by the time scale, because we get material into this disk. In order for this material to get to the central star, you have to lose angular momentum. Because they're spinning fast, you have to lose angular momentum. So what causes this angular momentum transport? We use molecular viscosity, and the time scale for that is enormous. It's 10 to the 15, 16 years. The solar system shouldn't be here, okay? But we know stars evolve on a much shorter time scale. So some kind of global instability must have been there to process this. That global instability can come in three or four different forms. At the moment, the central theme is gravitational instability. And when you have this massive disk form, effect of self-gravity can cause the growth of non-axisymmetric structures, which exert a torque and redistribute angular momentum, or MHD instabilities, and magnetic field can get stretched out. They can get, because there are differential rotation in this disk, you can have what's called magneto-rotational instability, and there are other potential possibilities. There are ideas, people talk about vortices, and they talk about different stuff. So there's a number of different processes. The central issue there is how do you redistribute this angular momentum, allow material to set up the environment, the nursery out of which planetary system can form. The second step, dust condensation. This occurs on the time scale of 100,000 years all the way up to a few million years, because we see signature of dust actually evolves on that time scale. How do we know that? We can see the spectra. We can see the sort of the dust reprocesses the stellar radiation. And of course, the different dusts have different sizes. They're not a single given size. They range from micron size all the way up to millimeter or larger. Okay? So as the dust spectra evolves, you can see different radiation at different wavelengths. You know, suppose you have a tiny dust which is only a few micron, and that dust is not very good at at absorbing photons, which is millimeter, right? Because the photon is too big compared to the size of the dust. So they primarily go through scattering, forward scattering. So by looking at the scattering signature versus the reprocessed radiation, you can tell something about the dust size distribution. Okay? So we know there's the evolution. We also know there's condensation going on, because we can look in the form of molecular lines that's still present in this gas form. We can look at signatures of these molecular lines, which have both rotational and vibrational band signatures. We can compare that with that of the dust. We see that most of the CO, carbon monoxide gases, more than 99% of that, it's drained out. Okay, mostly drained, condensed out into various type of ice grains. So there's a dust depletion. Why is it that we see this such an efficient dust depletion out there? It's because we're looking primarily at larger region of the disk, and the environment is such that the vapor phase, you get the system, they can condense very easily. Okay, they can condense all of this, these molecules very easily into the grain phase. Eventually, we will be able to probe in the central region of the disk, where there will be transitions, because as you go closer and closer to the center, the temperature rises. And not only by the solar heating, also by this effect, as the disk itself evolves, different parts of the disk transport angular momentum to the other parts of the disk by rubbing against different layers. And this viscous dissipation process generates its own heat. And that can also provide a local temperature which can melt the dust. For example, ice. Ice melts at about 160 degrees in this low pressure environment. And that location in the solar nebula is about 3 or so AU, astronomical unit. Astronomical unit is the distance scale between the Earth and the Sun. So it's 3 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. This is where all the ice grains, water ice grains, will melt. Okay? Now, Jupiter happened to be at 5.2 AU today. Okay? So Jupiter is outside this region where the grain melts. This is an important event. Okay, why is it? Now, other than hydrogen and helium, the most common element in the universe are carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen, right? So these objects tend to form these volatile ices. So if you can have the outer part of the solar system, they can all condense into grains, out of which they can grow into bigger objects. On the inside, they all evaporate. So the amount of material that's available to form terrestrial planets is much less in the solid form than is out there, okay? This may be the reason why things have different behaviors. But can we see this evaporation process? At the moment, we can't. Why is it we can't? Why can't you go back there to look at the signature of the gas? Because this gas, when it evaporates, it comes from a very small region in the central region of this, and where it's optically thick. We can't yet probe it. But eventually, we will have various spacecrafts. We will be able to use SOFIA and various other, this is a flying telescope, up going above the stratosphere, we will be able to see these, okay? We will be able to get these type of signatures. So theoretically, what's important is collisions between the ice grains. Under what condition do they stick together, grow to bigger objects? And it's a little bit like rain, to understand rain. And how do they stick together and they form bigger objects? And how do they affect their environment? Is it possible that they come down and by colliding and build up to bigger and bigger hailstorms, there is a problem. As they come down, you see, the gaseous disk moves around the central star. And they're moving at more or less what's called the Keplerian speed. The Keplerian speed is the speed at which the centrifugal force balances against gravity, okay? Now, but this gas sees another, feels another force. That's a pressure gradient. Near the center of the disk is hotter, and further away is cooler. So as a result, there is a pressure gradient which acts slightly against gravity. So as a result, when you go into the centrifugal balance, the gas moves at slightly slower than Keplerian speed. But the dust particles, they don't feel this. If they don't feel this, they feel that they don't feel the gas pressure, but they feel a systematic headwind. And that headwind causes a drag. And this drag is very effective in causing the orbit of these particles to move into the star. Okay? So dust, heavy elements in the disk and the gas, they evolve through different physical processes. There's no a priori reason for the dust and the gas to get into the center at the same rate. There is no physical a priori reason that why we should preserve the chemical homogeneities inside the stars. Why is it so homogeneous? What I'm going to tell you, that culprit here are the planets. Okay? So the dust can settle. The dust can settle. And if they settle, and if they don't grow in time, they will move right into the star. Somehow they have to grow in time. There are two schools of thought. One is that when they settle down to the midplane, they eventually become gravitationally unstable because there's such a large concentration of them near the midplane. Their own gravity starts to influence each other, and they will start to break up and they will collapse. But the further analysis show that if you collapse them near the midplane, the gravitational field near the midplane will start to be dominated by the dust. As a result, the fluid gets dragged by the dust near the midplane, whereas the dust gets dragged by the fluid at the top. So there's a shear layer, and that shear layer can generate shearing instabilities, prevent the dust from settling into a gravitationally unstable state. Okay? So this is an important process. Now, if they can't make it big through gravitational instability, what would they do? They would drift towards the center. As they drift towards the center, you have problems because the disk gets hotter and hotter. If I take an ice ball and get into a hotter, hotter region, and eventually gets inside the 3AU boundary mark, the ice line, and it evaporates. What happens when it evaporates? It gets into a vapor state. And then you want to diffuse. But the diffusion is much slower than this gas drag. Okay? You have a lot of stuff gets in there. So the question is, could you then get an enhancement of metallicity so enormous in these boundary region? And this is where you get the chemical fractionation that you see in the solar system. Now, those cosmic chemists will tell you, wait. You are telling us only part of the story. If I look at the isotopes, I see, you know, there's no clear cut in chemical composition gradient. But what they're telling you is the color of the hair. They're not telling you about the DNA molecules. Okay? So in this game, what is very important is to separate out what is the forest and where are the leaves. Leaves. Okay? And you really want to separate out those effects. Okay? So this is an important issue. Retention efficiency and what's available. Okay, I see time is also a challenge for me as well as for planets. And then the next step is once the grains start to grow, they will start to collide and they will start to build up bigger objects. What we see the remnants of this process, we have spacecrafts, we have deep spacecraft we send out there, and that takes a snapshot at these asteroids. We see the asteroids are covered with craters, just like what we see, on the moon. Even though the asteroid may be only a few kilometers in size, they're full of craters. It's clear that they got together by some sort of collision. Now, but the problem with that collision is that, the orbital velocity of the Earth going around the sun is 30 kilometers per second. if we have a tiny bit of eccentricity, we will be, let's say 1% eccentricity, we will be moving at about 300 meters per second. If I were to run into that wall at 300 meters per second, I won't stick to that wall. I will be all over the place. Okay? So how is it that these little objects, that they can collide at these characteristic speeds, and yet they can build up to bigger and bigger objects? Okay? So the reason for that, again, is one area where people have to combine not only collisional dynamics, but celestial mechanics. And they have to look at the orbit after they impact, if they splattered, and do they reconstitute? Do they they come back together, reassemble? And how do you put Humpty Dumpty back together again? Okay, so how do you do this process in this type of environment? This is a challenge. Not yet we see this challenge, because when we look at these asteroids, they are piles of loose gravels. How do we know that? Shoemaker-Levy 9 tells us that. Because when these objects fly by Jupiter, they get torn by the tidal field of Jupiter, and they get torn into pieces. When they get torn into pieces, and there are 17 pieces, then they zap, this object zap Jupiter, right? But by the fact that they can get torn into 17 pieces tells you that the material strength of these objects is very low. They were not very strongly bound together, okay? We also see it by looking at many of these asteroids are binary asteroids. We see these binaries going around each other. We can work out from the size they have and look at the period. And we know their mass. We know the size. So we know the density. We know the porosity. We see these objects are loose gravels. When you look at asteroids, you look at the craters on those. There are no sharp craters. They're not like a piece of shark rock that just chipped off. It looks like a pile of sand that you jump into the pile of sand, you leave an indent, but it's no sharp edge. So did Humpty Dumpty put together loosely as a pile of loose gravel? But then how do you do it in light of relatively weak gravity, repeated collisions? Okay, so that's another effect that's important. Now, so when we look at these asteroids, they have high spin. So that means, again, the grazing collision may be very important. So these could tell us a lot about collision process, what's going on. This collision process is very important because if they can collide, they can gradually build up in size. In this process of building up in size, what determines the rate of buildup are two things: their cross-sectional area and their velocity dispersion. What determines their velocity dispersion? They also perturb each other. So this is a truly active kinetic system. On the one hand, you have the coagulation of the particles to determine the size distribution, at the same time that their dynamical process is evolving also. Okay? So this eventually leads to the point that they become so big, they start to influence their background through their own gravity. Beyond the physical collision area, they can reach out and start to excite the velocity dispersion in the surrounding region. And at this point, you start to get into what is called the oligarchic growth limit. Okay, there are two limits inside these terrestrial core growth. One is called the oligarchic growth. Basically, what happens is when you start to kick up too much dust, you can't grow anymore. It's like Merrill Lynch, right, or Fidelities. When they become too big, whatever they do, they influence the market. Okay, so these guys can start to influence the kinetics in the background, and then they get into a limit. But suppose that the background can be damped in the presence of gas. You can damp them all down, because all of these processes must occur at the time when the gas was still around in order to build Jupiter. Okay, suppose that happens. And then during that process, what would lead to, what would happen? So you damp down. If you keep on damping down, and then you can ask, eventually, would my growth go on forever? And the point is that it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't is that eventually you get into what is called the feeding zone. Because in order for me to attract material from my surrounding region, they must feel my gravity. But if they move too fast relative to me, then they won't be perturbed enough to be attracted to get onto my body. Okay? Now, what is too fast? Well, in this disk, everybody is moving around in Keplerian speed. Okay, so if I am here, the planets, planetesimals are inside of me, they move too fast relative to me. Further away than me, they move too slow. So they have a relative motion relative to me, and if they get too far away from me, I can't pull them in. So this is called the feeding zone. Eventually, if I use up everything within the feeding zone, I get into what is called an isolation mass. These are all jargons, but the point is that there is a growth limit. In the presence of gas, I can't go too far in the inner part of the solar system. I get stuck. I'm moving through molasses and I can't go too fast. What is that limit for the solar system? And it's typically a fraction of Earth's mass. You don't produce Earth and Venus.
And that leads to the stability?
Ultimately, yes, but not yet. That's not enough to give you the stability, but you're right on the track. And then further away, the time scale for growth is slow because there's longer dynamical time scale, and there is also not as much material. They're more sparsely populated. So it takes them a long time to do things. But right in the middle part, where the ice start to condense, and that region, you may have an enhancement of surface density, and it is that region where Jupiter formed. That is the region where the first giant gaseous giant planets will form. And there is a preferred location for giant planet formation. Okay, I'll come back to a little bit later to tell you, even though they always prefer to form at about a few AU, they can be all over the place after they're formed. Okay. So now, after these cores are formed, they still interact with the background gas. It turns out as they interact with the background gas, it's no longer through gas hydrodynamic drag, but through tides. The gas on the inside move faster, the gas on the outside move slower. So the presence of these terrestrial planets or cores, they want to slow down these guys on the inside, speed up the guys from the outside. And normally, if there's a perfect balance, you remove angular momentum from the inside, you give it to the outside. You don't go anywhere, okay? But because of various geometrical effects, there may be a slight offset, which can cause things to move inwards. And this is a point of contention that we need to understand why planets, even though theoretically we think there's a tendency for these cores to all rush into the sun, but our mere presence tells us that didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Okay. But in any event, we know the gas can damp out the eccentricity. Once the gas starts to become big, I mean the core becomes big, like the Earth, we know our escape velocity is 11 kilometers per second. In this gaseous environment, the temperature of the gas is about 100 degrees. So the sun speed of the gas is only 1 kilometer per second. If I have something this big, I can certainly attract the gas. After all, the temperature of this atmosphere out here is being bound by the gravity of the Earth, and that temperature is just about the temperature of the solar nebula. How come I didn't accrete an enormous amount of envelope of gas? Why didn't Earth have a huge gaseous envelope? And the reason for it is the moment I start to accrete this gas, and this gas would want to fall into the gravitational potential and near this core. And it has to release some gravitational energy. And that energy cannot get out easily. It gets bottled up. Okay? It gets bottled up. It requires radiation transfer to get this energy out. It causes the setup of hydrostatic envelope. In this hydrostatic envelope, you have most part of the hydrostatic envelope is convectively unstable. So he gets transported by convection. But there are layers, which is radiative, and that provides a bottleneck. Unless you can diffuse the radiation goes through there, and the radiation can't get out, you remain at hydrostatic equilibrium. Okay? You have this environment that keeps you going, and then in the meantime, you have little planetesimal bombarding you. Now, there's a steady bombardment, The steady bombardment, most of this material just like meteorites. They don't make it to the bottom. They make it to the top, okay? And they dissolve in the top. So you start to get into a chemical gradient, a molecular weight gradient. And it's ideal condition for double diffusive instability. Okay, so you can have turnovers, you can have all this type of process going on. Every now and then, you get one of these major impacts. And it will happen very frequently in the early solar system. One key question is that if I had an Earth and I had a few impactors, what is the critical impact that it will hit me? So I will repeatedly lose all of the envelope that I had acquired, the hydrostatic envelope I have acquired at the first place. Okay, but eventually I get sufficiently massive. When I get sufficiently massive down here, then the more massive I have, the greater the pressure I need to have here to support a massive envelope on top of me, okay? Because I have now stronger gravitational force field. So that means the hotter it is near the bottom. The hotter it is near the bottom, that means the larger the radiative flux it is to the outside. So I can cool off faster and faster, and there's a critical mass beyond which that I can cool and I can start to accrete gas. That is the onset of rapid accretion of gas, provided you can get this process going before the gas is depleted in the disk, and then you can form gas giants. Now that is not a trivial matter, because it takes time for the core to form. In the meantime, the gas is evaporated because of ultraviolet radiation from surrounding region. They photoevaporate this gas and they get depleted. Okay, we see this type of evidence by looking at what is called probelets. We look at the Orion region, we see gas is being evaporated by nearby star. And it's a competition. Again, I come back to the time scale problem. So we got to get the core there. And this is why these gas giants like Jupiter wants to form right at this preferred region near the ice condensation region, where we don't have the isolation mass. The isolation mass is bigger near here, okay? And the time scale is relatively short. This is the ideal location, okay? It is once you form that, so Jupiter, even though it has a core like Earth, even though it has to go through a process like Earth, what I'm trying to tell you is Jupiter probably formed before the final assembly of the Earth. Before, we're only talking about a few million years. So what constitutes the final assembly of the Earth? Gas depletion. Now, why is gas depletion important? In the presence of gas, I got into isolation because my eccentricity is all dissipated. So I can't get very far. I can only go out to this far. But if I can go beyond isolation, if those other planetesimals have velocity dispersion that's much larger than the width of my feeding zone, okay? Because they can go through orbit crossing, they can go through excursion, but I have to allow them to be able to get their eccentricity excited. In the presence of the gas, they can't. If the gas goes away, they can get excited. But that's not enough of the story, okay? Because if that's the story, all I have is a whole bunch of oligarchs. They all got to this big, they were waiting to go, they were waiting for the good opportunity to take off, okay? So when Saddam Hussein was eliminated, they were all fighting each other. So it's more chaotic than ever before, okay? So you don't want to just have that. You want to have something else that comes in. So what is that some other missing ingredient in the case of the solar system? The presence of Jupiter. Now, why is that important? Laplace realized that the presence of Jupiter exerted a perturbation on Saturn in such a way that normally they just go around the sun, but they have this perturbation, they perturb each other a little bit. They change the direction, their eccentricity a little bit. The way they change their eccentricity a little bit is to change the direction of periapsis. These eccentric orbits has a preferred direction. By changing that direction of this periapsis, you can work out the tiny little difference in the angular momentum that a particle would have as they go around the star. It's like a precession. Okay, there will be a precession. And this precession, as it changes this precession, it change angular momentum. Okay? Now normally this type of perturbation is extraordinarily weak. Except if you happen to have this precession frequency and there's a change at the same time you change something to Jupiter. If you can also cause Jupiter to change, then you can be in phase. If you just happen to be moving always in certain phase, and it's almost like surfing on the beach, right? And if you just pick a surfboard and the wave comes and goes and you don't go anywhere. But if you catch the phase, you can go a long way. Now, what could cause this phase change? Well, precession, right? Precession. Now, it's because when we look at an elliptical orbit, now, if you have a point mass, that elliptical orbit, it's closed. But we know if the gravitational potential is not a point mass, there's a precession. We know from relativity. We know Einstein told us that. Okay? Now, I have all this disk material. This material is also providing gravity that modifies the gravitational force field. It causes precession. Okay, it causes precession. But as this material goes down, this precession frequency changes. At some point, no matter how big or how small how big you start out the disk, at some point as you deplete, that precession frequency starts to become the same as the precession frequency caused by Jupiter on any of the planetesimals. You get into what is called sweeping secular resonance. Okay, sweeping secular resonance. And as this sweeping secular resonance pass through the inner part of the solar system, it shakes things up. Everybody gets shaken. Okay, everybody gets shaken. There are a few who manage to survive the shaking up. Okay, who are those who manage to survive the shaking up? The big guys. Okay, the Microsoft, the IBMs, they survive. Why do they survive? Because they also exert a tide on the rest of the disk. So they get very effective damping. In this declining process, you get this type of process. So you shake up the little guys, the little guys gets acquired by the big guys. And the big guys doesn't get shaken up. And that is how you go from a dynamically filled system into a dynamically porous system. Okay? Now, does this happen everywhere around every planetary system? We don't know.
In our planetary system, supposedly there was another planet that was actually broken up.
Well, that's a conjecture. Yeah. And there are many reasons why this probably would be difficult. Okay, this is very difficult. You're talking about the region of the asteroid belt. Okay, and there is no clear evidence that that is the remnants of something. I mean, we know that objects have been broken up, okay, because I only told you part of the story, as I said. I'm only telling you the best part, okay. And there are meteorites which are made of pure iron. Okay, now these meteorites must have been broken up from a much bigger object which managed to have its radioactive energy released from the radioactive decay to melt the interior and then broken up. So there are clear evidence things did get broken up, okay? So that these collisions at 300 meters per second, they must have broken up some stuff. Now, but whether a big object was built up there, there's no strong reasons to suggest that would be the case. And the presence of Jupiter itself can start to perturb that region very violently during the formation process. And it's very difficult to get things formed. Okay, so I think I will skip some stuff. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about post-formation evolution. Okay, now after all of this is said and done, how do I get some of these big gaseous giant planets close to the star? Okay, what happens? Well, suppose I form this very fast. After I form it very fast, then what happens is I'm going to start to exert a influence on the rest of the disk. What do? I try to slow down the disk on the inside because it's moving too fast. just like the moon is trying to slow down the spin of the Earth. And I try to speed up the disk on the outside because it's moving too slowly. So as a result, this guy, I take angular momentum away from the inside and give it to the outside. And the inside, after it loses angular momentum, what does it do? It moves inwards. The outside, what does it do? Moves outwards. I open up a gap. Okay? If I open up a gap, that means my build-up process through gas accretion is over. Okay? I can't reach the rest of this anymore. So exactly how do I, so there's a self-growth limit. Just like fidelity, there's a self-growth limit. I can't go very far. But if I keep on taking angular momentum away from the inside, this material on the inside eventually will drift towards the star. This stuff gets lost. But the outer part of this is still being supplied by infolding material, and that stuff, it piles up near where I am, because it gives to the next guy, and it piles up near where I am, so it's going to drift me into the sun. Okay, so this process will happen. The faster you build your planets, the faster this process will happen. Because I said all of the material in the star went through this. Okay, so if I have left behind not 2%, but 5% or 10% of the heavy element in the disk, then I will grow this core so fast, I will form these gas giant planets, and then I will couple my evolution towards the star with that of the disk. I will end up inside the sun. Okay? Now, is there any evidence that such dramatic event took place in the history of star formation? We see young stars. Every 10 to the 4 years or so, it pops up in its luminosity by about 4 or 5 orders of magnitude. Over the period of about a decade, 10 times the mass of Jupiter gets accreted onto those stars. Okay? So accretion onto the central star is not a smooth event. There have been things that happens and that gets dumped, and this get dumped. There's no reason to suggest you have to build up a company by gradually acquiring this employee, that employee. You swallow. You swallow other companies, okay? And this is how you build up these giant planets. And you build up these giant planets, and you build up the central star, okay? So, and this process may have keep on going until we run out of material. So what we see is the last of the Mohicans, okay? It is a process of self-elimination. It is a self-regulated process. It is only through that type of process we can leave behind a chemically homogeneous system of stars. At the same time, we can have the ubiquitous production of planets. Because the two things are, it's a dichotomy. If you leave behind too much, you form stars with too little metallicity. If you leave behind too little, you don't form any planets. So how do you account for the two? You go through self-regulation. Okay? Now, after all this is done, the shake-up is important for the solar system because it made us not to go through what we will call a chaotic evolution, continuation of an oligarchic state. The oligarchic state will continue until there are one or two planets left. They will, when you see it, you will know it. And you look at a system, this is a continuation of oligarchic growth. It will have large eccentricity. It will have dynamical instability on the time scale of the age of the system. Okay? We don't have that system. The solar system is not that system. It doesn't mean that other systems are not. Because we see this large eccentricity distribution. It is entirely possible that all of these other systems will have developed different things. So how do you develop that? How is it possible that these other systems have such a different properties as ours? Well, after you form the first planet, okay, you open up a gap. Then it turns out it becomes very inducive to form the next one. Okay, why is that? And the reason for that is once you open up a gap, then the density distribution, the pressure distribution in this disk is no longer monotonic. In the region of the gap, inside gap, I have no gas, I have no pressure. In this region outside the gap, I have pressure and density. So the pressure gradient is positive. And this positive pressure gradient, okay, actually strengthened the influence of gravity pointing towards center. So the gas in this region, out just beyond the gap, rotates at super Keplerian speed. Any dust particle gets too near the gap, they get trapped. They get trapped there, they accumulate. Once you form one, you find there is a reason for additional planets to form. In fact, when Deborah Fisher looked at all her planets, for every one that she finds, so although there's only 10% of the stars in her sample, has planets around them. For those which have planets, when she looks again more carefully at the data, she sees more than half of these guys have additional planets around them. Okay? So it's like, do a population census, and you find families without children. But any family with one child, it's almost by more than half the chance that they will have more than one.
So in the end, if you beginning to build a theory of Boltzmann.
No.
Exactly.
Those systems without planets in inverted commas may have long period planets.
Right. Now, those who without Jupiter mass planets.
Short enough period Jupiter mass planets.
Now, this is an interesting question. If you go to long period, as I mentioned to you, that the growth time scale for the core is long. The growth scale for the core is longer than it takes for the gas to disappear. So these guys will have an envelope. The envelope will have a mass, maybe a few percent of the mass of the core. Okay? And these objects will get left behind. The gas goes away. And these objects can be left behind to be the seed of the gas, the ice giants. The ice giants themselves, there's no reason why they could not collide, because they didn't go through this dynamical shakeup. Okay, so they can collide, and they too can form other things. Okay, so now this is what led to the dynamical diversity. But in addition to internal shakeup, there's also external shakeup. All stars are born in clusters. Okay, it's just like most people are born in cities. All stars are born in clusters, so they get influenced by the presence of other stars. Those stars are very far away. How could they be influenced? Because the secular perturbation effect does not require close encounters. They can build up through this distant encounters, and they can build up. And if that eccentricity causes them to cross their orbit, if they're dynamically filled, they can cross the orbit. Then you get into dynamical instability and completely isotropize the dynamical system. It is by accident that Laplace was able to realize that the solar system formed out of a disk. In such a hot environment, there's no reason for these planets to even remain in the disk, because there's an adiabatic invariance which links the eccentricity with the inclination. And you can actually have a very puffy planetary system. Okay, so let me just wrap up, because I didn't say everything I wanted to say, but let me just wrap up with three messages I would like to have you take home with. Now, one is the dynamical, the dominant process of giant planet formation, because we see the giant planets today. Okay, I described one theory. Namely, the theory is truly a theory of planet formation. In the sense, this is different from a star formation. It didn't collapse just from in one go. It built up a core, and then the core gradually built up around other things. The central star plays a dominant role. Okay, and remember what I said about the definition of planets. Okay, planets can be here and it can be kicked out, so they become free floaters. just because an object moves around a central star, this is not all of the story. I think the story has to be how it's formed. There is a competing theory. Most of the theorists here do not buy, but I think it is worthwhile to really study it, because we need to distinguish between whether planets form, giant planets like Jupiter mass planets, form through this gradual process, or do they collapse from a cloud in the disk like a star. Okay, if they did that, then the presence of gas giants does not imply the presence of terrestrial planets like us. But whereas if it did, along the story I told you, then the presence of gas giants, or even the absence of gas giants, will tell you that cores are ubiquitous. Because for every gas giant that we see, there's got to be some other terrestrials. For those which we don't see, there should still be failed cores, okay? And because they just didn't get there in time. So it has got important implications. But that's the first message. The second message is availability of planetary building material. What I want to convey the information is that there's plenty of material. And the question is whether you look at the first stage or you look at the other latter stage. It's a competing process. The first stage, you've got to do things fast, but you have plenty of material to do things with. And the last stage, you can take all your time, even for the gas giants, the ice giants. In the end, they can still evolve onwards. They just don't get much more gas, that's all, okay? And they can still go on. And we see evidence of that they had perhaps major impact. We see the tilt of Uranus, and we see, for example, that the moon of the Earth have made of composite material, which primarily come from the surface material of the Earth. So all of these things tells you that giant impact could have taken place later, but we also have a constraint. How much giant impact could there be? Because, again, come back to the stellar homogeneity. We can witness the post-formation evolution of stars or planetary systems by looking very carefully on the differential metallicity of the stars, because these stars, when they zap the central star, they will leave behind a scar. We can look at those scars. What does that mean? It can pollute a little bit of the background. So what is the limit on that pollution? What can we see? So, and this is the second point. The third point is dynamical signature. This is a story of evolution. The question is whether it's a continuous and stable evolution, or is it a metastable evolution? I think in the theory of biological evolution, there is a Darwinian theory, there's a Lamarckian theory. Okay, do you go through these steps? Do you go through these catastrophes? Now, catastrophes can be caused from inside, as I give you one example of sweeping secular resonance. It could come from outside because of stellar encounter in the early stages. Most of these stellar clusters dissolve shortly after. Okay, if you do these things relatively fast in the early stages, and we should be able to see patterns of evolution. Today, we can only look at stars, try to find planets around stars which are mature. Because only around those stars which are mature, you can get very, very sharp spectral lines, so we can start to detect the planets. But with SIM, Space Interferometer Mission, we won't be able to look at the direct image, looking at the wobble of the stellar image, okay, through interferometer. And then we can look at young stars. Then we can do a population analysis. Has there been a change? And the verification of that change is a verification of Poincaré, who came a long circle. We had a hero. Hero was Laplace, who gave us the basic foundation of how to form planets. But in the end, it was his arch rival, although they didn't live at the same time, but his arch rival, who won the end of the day. Thank you.
That was a remarkable view. Probably the first time no one has used any prompt. Very impressive. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Can you talk about abundances in the solar system?
Yes.
You mentioned different temperatures that things condense. Is it clear that it's temperature?
No, it's not just,
particle mass.
The sedimentation becomes important, but they all get sorted out. But temperature and pressure and density, they're all important, okay? So I just give the temperature as only one example. But it's dominated by temperature because it's dominated perhaps by the central stellar heating. So that seems to be one of the edge, the actual, no, it's not clear, okay? But the edge is actually could be very fuzzy because there's a lot of turbulence that goes out. But what we see is that if we use very simple-minded scenarios, models, which is called equilibrium condensation model, we can essentially get the right picture, okay? But then if you then try to be a little bit more sophisticated, I have to be fair, you have to be a little bit more sophisticated, you can use isotopes to probe, okay? And they're very sensitive. And then you get a completely different picture. And you would say the temperature, with here and there and there, they're all very similar. There's been enormous amount of mix, and there's all this or the other. But the question is, do the isotopes really tell you the story how these things were formed? Maybe they're just coding at the last bit they were thrown in, because you're not looking at the main mass, you're looking at tracers. Okay, I mean you look at a politician, you don't look at just the dirt that anybody else threw at him or her, right? You look at the substance. So what is the substance? If you look at the substance, and then there is a gradient. If you look at the dirt, there isn't. Everybody is the same. They all have words.
We can planets in binary stars.
Very good question. More than half the stars in the sky are binaries. And if we exclude them, it would be very problematic. While there are, if we just want to know how they form, it's not prohibited. We can, in fact, have disk extents out there. Whether they can survive, that's another story, okay? Now, there are many dynamical perturbations. If they're in the plane, there are dynamical perturbations already in existence. But if they're out of the plane, there's reason you could have it out of the plane. If they're out of the plane, and then those perturbations even stronger. But there are many binary systems whose binary separation is very, very wide. And there, the perturbation is not so important. Let me just give you an example of a binary. The separation is very wide. The Earth and the Moon versus the Sun, right? We managed to form the Moon around the Earth. We are a binary, and we managed to do it. So it's not a real fantastic challenge, okay? It is just, most people think, oh, it's impossible. But if you just look around us, it's not a big deal.
Coming back to the moon, every planet has a moon.
Ah, good. Except the terrestrials. It's more difficult for the terrestrials. Okay. Now the gas giant, in fact, they provide a very, very important constraint. Okay, when the moon formed, because this gaseous material, and if time scale is a problem for forming the planets around the sun. But for the for the moons, it's even worse, okay? And we have some constraints that some of the moons didn't form that rapidly, because if they form very rapidly, the interior will all get molten, and then the heavy elements will go in the inside, and the light ones goes outside. You look at one of the Galilean moons, Callisto, and that doesn't seem to suggest, it seems to be very homogeneous, so it didn't form that rapidly. And that is a challenge. And to get the moons out in a disk, it's not too difficult, because I have material accreted onto the central star. They still have angular momentum. They form a secondary disk around the planets rather naturally. But the detailed process, how this condensable material went through and then built up this material, and that's the difficult part. And the other thing that's interesting is that you could say, well, most of this heavy element came from late-stage bombardment. If they came from late-stage bombardment, it could have very important implications about the satellite systems. Okay, so that also provides a constraint. So I think to form the moons around planets is not difficult, but to form moons around moons of planets, that's more difficult. Okay, because the moons of the Earth, the same side of the moon of Earth faces Earth. Okay, because of tide. Right now, if you put another moon around that moon, the tidal effect will cause that moon to spiral into this moon. It's very difficult to do that effect. Yes.
What about variations in stellar output? Couldn't that move around these zones?
Yes.
Also, either just slow variations or a fast burst when you swallow a planet or something.
Right. This will almost certainly have major effects, and they would change the, for example, even UV flux. It can change a lot of different things. And how the planet gets swallowed is also an interesting story, which I didn't go into. I had it on the slides, but I didn't have time to go into. And there are lots of so-called hot Jupiters, and these hot Jupiters, they get very close to the star. They can tidally interact with the star to the point that they can liberate a lot of energy within the planet, and that will inflate them. You can have runaway inflation. They will overflow their Rosh radius, and they can get disrupted. And that could then change some early evolution of the star as well. Okay? For example, that one thing that is very important in changing the early evolution of the star is a star, although it has a lot of mass, it really doesn't have a lot of angular momentum, because the moment of inertia is, it's so small. And so if you put a planet just outside, and it can soak up the angular momentum of the star, it can change the angular momentum of the star to the point that then you will slow down the star, then instead of having the star pushing you out, it may pull you in, okay? So, and this type of evolution may have some observational signatures, but these are topics I haven't yet touched on during this talk. But there are many, many interesting problems. There's an infinite number of problems compared to collider physics. Oh, sorry.
Yes. The more general remark, you stress how much the field is driven by observations, but on the other hand side, especially in the case of planetary systems, as you said, there are strong selection effects. So wouldn't it be also correct to say that in some aspects, really, computer simulations drive the field?
Oh, yes.
And sometimes observations and computer simulations have led to things like, say, oligarchic growth or some types of migration, which have been observed in computer simulations,
yes,
rather than in real observations. And
yes.
Some
yes, I agree.
You're not biased, are you?
No, I think this is an important point.
Of course it is. Of course it is. I agree. I'm biased as well.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.